will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Dr. Martin Luther King never lived to see that dream come true. And although that dream still lives today in the hearts and minds of millions of Americans, Dr. King's personal relationship with freedom ended on April 4, 1968. On that day, while in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot down by an assassin. Today on Insight, on the anniversary of Dr. King's birth, we discuss his death with a close friend, Reverend Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jackson, let's return to that fateful day in April of 1968. You were with him in Memphis. Can you describe the scene?
We were in the midst of a conversation at Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. We were on the way to dinner at Reverend Billy Kyle's home. We were in the midst of a major strike in the city. Garbage workers had been striking to get a livable wage and to get dues checked off and to get their union recognized. And that was a measure of tension in the city. There had been some precipitous violence a few days before, but things were moving at a fair pace, and things had taken a turn in our direction, and so the signing of a contract was imminent. On the way to dinner, and while in the midst of the conversation, I was standing on the ground, he was on the balcony, second floor, outdoor balcony. Just as he walked away, the bullet struck him in the neck, went down into his chest, exploded, blew his heart out, and he died instantly. When I turned, and of course, the Reverend Andrew Young was in the courtyard, Reverend James Bevel was in the courtyard, a number of staff members, because all of us had converged on Memphis. There were so many police in the area. I always remember saying, "Don't shoot." As I ran toward the steps, to go up the steps where he was lying, I was saying, "Don't shoot." There were so many of them in the area with their guns out. And I got the impression that the bullet came from on top of the hill where they say James Earl Ray was. And when we rushed to the top of the steps and got to Dr. King, I remember Reverend Billy Kyles reaching to get a blanket to put over Dr. King. It was a rather chilly late evening. And a Justice Department official who had been visiting our room for most of that day actually extended the towel to attempt to stop the bleeding in his neck. And that is how close someone from the Justice Department was on that occasion. And then there were bits and pieces of information flying around Memphis immediately thereafter that did not add up at that time. For example, some people came down and said that all of the traffic lights running east and west between Memphis and Arkansas, that for about 15 minutes they were all green going in one direction. Well, in the state of shock that we were in, and not being lawyers, that kind of information didn't make much sense. But James Earl Ray was in the building next door to the fire department at 6 o'clock, did make his escape down Main Street during the height of the traffic hour, did know who we were, even though he had just come in town, did get across the state line, and eventually got out of the country and, of course, was found abroad with money in his pocket.
When did federal authorities tell you or other leaders of the black community that they had a suspect whose name was James Earl Ray or Eric Gault?
Well, it was some months later. I actually think that at the time that it occurred, that we were in such shock by the assassination, until most of us internalized it and did not get very deep and detailed in terms of probing. I remember over and over again we would say something to the effect that it doesn't matter who killed Dr. King, the only thing that matters is what killed Dr. King, and what killed him was a sick, racist society. What killed him was a society that was intolerable of the voice of prophecy. And of course, that was true, but it did not negate the fact that we should have gone in much greater depth, even at that time. We were so bewildered psychologically at the time that the trial was killed rather instantly. We didn't even protest about the matter, because our heart was not in relating very much to Memphis anymore, but going on to Washington.
Well, since that time, there's been a great deal of protest, and we'll continue with our discussion of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in just a moment. Reverend Jesse Jackson is our guest today, and we're talking about the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Reverend Jackson, what are the specific areas of agreement that you have with federal authorities, and what are the areas of disagreement that you have with them as far as the assassination of Dr. King is concerned?
Well, I do not know the areas that we agree and disagree in a measure of detail. For example, we contend that the government was involved in the assassination of Dr. King, and they wouldn't agree with that publicly at this time.
Do you have any proof to back that up at all?
Well, we only have circumstantial information. That is, that for them to put out a memo saying that the FBI's role was to disrupt, discredit, or otherwise destroy black organizations, that it was the function of the FBI to stop the rise of a black messiah.
Now, that was a memo from J. Edgar Hoover.
From J. Edgar Hoover, a black messiah being defined as one who could mobilize a great and vast number of black people. For he interpreted any move towards social change as subversive, and interpreted any leader who would get that spontaneity from the crowd as communistic. And of course, he had this phobia. Hoover had the psychosis. Now, he combined that with the memo that was revealed that Hoover had sent to Dr. King, trying to embarrass him out of going to get the Nobel Peace Prize, or giving him the option of suicide. Then certainly the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming that the FBI either had the drive to kill Dr. King, or to know of his killing and not pursue stopping it very vigorously.
So you're suggesting that they had more of a motive than James Earl Ray?
Indeed. But the extent to which James Earl Ray was an agent would make them one and the same. After all, James Earl Ray was one man, and he could not have come into Memphis as late as he did come in and have such a precise location. I cannot forget the night before, and I always thought it was strange when Dr. King came in the city, that not only did they reveal that Dr. King was in the city and that we were going to have a mass meeting, but they gave out the hotel room number, 306. They gave out the room number at that time. And James Earl Ray came to town, of course. He was in a shack up on a hill, literally behind some bushes. And he had to be operating with great precision. And for him to get out of that building and get out of the city, across state lines and out of the country, and to have gone through the identity adjustments he had to make at the borders was virtually impossible.
There is discrepancy as to who selected the Lorraine Motel. Some suggest that it was the decision was made by FBI agents. Others suggest that it was black leaders that did it.
Well, there's no discrepancy. We had been staying in the Lorraine Motel all alone as we had come to Memphis. We
so
had,
that part of the conspiracy story is bunk as far as
yeah, it
concerned.
Really is. You know, we were heading up a program here in Chicago at the time called Operation Breadbasket. Breadbasket was about economic development for black people, building black banks and insurance companies and hotels and other various places that represent economic growth for our people. And it would have been inconsistent for us to have been in Memphis fighting to uplift the downtrodden black people and the black sanitation workers and to not stay in a black-owned motel, which was, needless to say, it was decent enough, clean enough, and roomy enough for us to stay in. We stayed there. We had our meals there. So that was a decision made by the organization without any inducement from anybody.
Our guest today is Reverend Jesse Jackson, director of Operation Push and one of the leading civil rights leaders in the country, who was with Dr. Martin Luther King when he was assassinated on April 4th of 1968. There is more evidence to be presented, more conjecture to be discussed, and we'll do that when we continue with our interview with Reverend Jesse Jackson on tomorrow's Insight program. Tomorrow on Insight, we will continue our discussion with Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Insight with Bruce Dumont is presented through the facilities of WNIS-FM. The views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of NBC News or WNIS. Insight with Bruce Dumont.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson is our guest today, and we continue a discussion which we began yesterday on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and we were talking about some of the evidence that is available. One of the important persons in this case, obviously, is the person who is the accused assassin and the convicted assassin, and that is James Earl Ray. Because he is so important, do you know of any move by either black leadership or by the government to give him extra protection?
No, I don't. You see, what I think we need to deal with about James Earl Ray is the circumstantial evidence in the case that he could not have engaged in the assassination alone. Secondly, he himself...
Just because he's a bumbler. Or his record was as a bumbler and as someone who has never, ever done anything right in his life.
Well, really, even if he had been Paladin, to have gotten out of Memphis at 6 o'clock during the rush hour and across state lines and out of the country alone, that is combined now with the fact that he said he's still alive, you see, and he says himself he did not do it alone. Apparently, his money has run out, and he has felt betrayed by his co-conspirators. And for some reason or the other, the judge is reluctant to allowing a man who's alive come before the court and say before oath he did not act alone and perhaps name his co-conspirators. It seems to me that only an agency of government would have the power to keep this trial from coming back to court. I think that it may very well indicate that Watergate started before Watergate. And I am concerned about this case being reopened.
Your own personal security, are you concerned about it, and what changes have you made in your lifestyle, let's say, in the last 3 to 6 months since some of the revelations about the FBI have come out?
Well, I've not made any adjustments in the last 3 to 6 months because for the length of time I've been involved in this movement since I was a teenager, in the movement in the early 60s, we have been victims of police harassment, of the FBI conveniently turning its head when Ku Klux Klansmen were in the territory. We've been victims of our phone lines being tapped, our basic rights interfered with, our organizations infiltrated. And yet 10 years ago, if we had shared these revelations, and when we did share them, the government had so much credibility, and we were denounced so badly as agitators and irresponsible people until people could not hear us at that time. And so, in some sense, what is radical now is the news coverage on what, for us, represents old events.
In other words, the press is finally telling it like it is, like it has been in the black community for
years. For a long time. You know, some sociologists indicate that the black community may very well be a weather vane for all things good that take place in the country and the economy. We're on the bad end of the low end of that weather vane. And when things are happening bad, as we move toward a police state and other kind of measures that are not so desirable, we're on the front end. When it comes to the issue of increase in pay, we're on the back end of that. When it comes to buying decent houses and expanding, we're on the back end. But when it comes to doctors sterilizing women, when it comes to introducing dope, when it comes to wiretapping and other forms of experimentation, when it comes to drafting soldiers for war, we're on the front end of those movements. And, of course, we're tired of that.
What would be the reaction in the black community if it was conclusively proven that there was a conspiracy in the Martin Luther King case and that there was complicity by an agency of the government?
Well, that would be shrieking horror in terms of people crying out saying it's a moral disgrace.
Would there be riots?
But we don't have the leverage to legislatively change anything. And I doubt very seriously if that would be in the riots in the street. That probably would be just another blow to any chances of confidence in this government being restored. On the other hand, you know, I might ask you the question, if it were conclusively revealed that Robert and John Kennedy's assassinations were the result of a group of white people in this country, of foreign leaders outside this country, what would be the white reaction? Would there be riots in the streets, or do you think there would be war abroad?
There would be, I think, further disgust for the American system, and a further loss of confidence in government, and that's exactly what would happen. I would like to follow up on that. We'll do that when we continue with our guest today, Reverend Jesse Jackson. Bruce Dumont back on Insight with our guest, Reverend Jesse Jackson. Mr. Jackson, one of the things that has been discussed in the last couple of months and has created quite a bit of stir, and that is the alleged use of a memo to blackmail Dr. Martin Luther King. And
white male.
Right. White male. Okay. When you look at the evidence in the particular case, there are numerous stories that J. Edgar Hoover played tapes of Dr. Martin Luther King allegedly having affairs with women throughout the country. One thing that has never been addressed is to whether there was any truth to the charges of Dr. King's questionable activities. Can you add any light to that at all?
I can only add light and bring clarity to that which we do know. And that is that in the face of this tremendous pressure from this government to betray our people, Dr. King did not bow. When Hoover suggested that Dr. King should not get the Nobel Prize and that the committee had made a bad choice in selecting him, Dr. King did go and get the Nobel Prize. We do know that when he came back, that Lyndon Johnson suggested that the time was not right to get a voting rights bill for black people, and that Hoover suggested that when Dr. King went to Alabama, he was inspired by communists. He went nonetheless and made a very American and a very profound thing happen. He created enough momentum to get a voting rights bill. We know that beyond that, Dr. King led the war on the prophetic end to get people out of Vietnam, where we'd lost over 50,000 lives, white and black lives. And now it's easy to talk about come out of Vietnam, but he was on the prophetic end of that movement, and we do know finally that he died trying to get a job or an income for everybody. So what we know is that in the face of this tyrannical pressure, he did not bow. And I think distortion.
We don't really challenge that. You know that was a dastardly thing for J. Edgar Hoover to do. The question was: is there a degree of hypocrisy when someone says something publicly and does something else privately, as far as morals and morality is concerned? And what I'm asking is there any truth to the charges that were made about Dr. King?
Well, not to my knowledge, but I would suggest this about the question of his personal morality. What would be inconsistent if Dr. King had spent most of his time on challenging personal morals, as do some of the evangelical types do, who declare, don't smoke, and yet behind doors they smoke, you know, a series of don'ts. He was basically about changing the social conditions in this society, and he was true to that calling. And I think that even now, when people raise the questions about his personal morality, somehow I get the feeling that it is an attempt to distort what he really was about. That's my basic impression on that question.
Where do we go from here as far as the reexamination of the evidence? What would you like to see done? A special prosecutor, congressional investigation, blue ribbon investigation, the black leadership investigate? What do you want to see happen?
Well, I would hope that the concern for Dr. King's life and what he contributed to this nation and to this world would not be solely limited to a black concern. I resent the notion of Dr. King being called a black leader, and I resent being called a black leader. I am a moral leader by virtue of my training and concern, and my blackness is self-evident. We don't call Wallace white governor. We don't call Ford white president. And we have the capacity to rise beyond the limitations of our ethnicity. Dr. King was an ethical leader. And to that extent, all people concerned about ethics, all people concerned about First Amendment rights, ought to be concerned about the conspirators in the assassination of Dr. King. Where we go from here, really, is to raise the issues that he raised during his lifetime. He laid out a very, very sound visionary proposition, and that is that on the one hand, we need to engage in the kind of social transformation that will provide a job or an income for everybody, livable wages, decent hospital care, and clothing. On the other hand, he dealt with personal transformation and morals to the extent that he believed that we could not go where we want to go if we are killing, robbing, stealing, and lying. And so I close simply by saying that he left the program. It is the job of those of us who live to implement it.
Our guest today, Reverend Jesse Jackson, director of Operation Push and a close friend of the late Dr. Martin Luther King. That is our program for today and this week, and our special thanks to Reverend Jesse Jackson for being with us today and yesterday. I'm Bruce Dumont. Have yourself a very nice weekend.
Insight with Bruce Dumont is presented through the facilities of WNIS-FM. The views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of NBC News or WNIS.